in 5, 4, 3.
Higher performance and faster and more reliable.
OpenPaddock.net Podcast, episode 245, Tuesday, August 19th, 2014. 70-year-old Max Verstappen set to be the youngest driver in Formula One history with Scuderia Toro Rosso in 2015. Will Power commands at Milwaukee, and there's an exciting team merger we'll get into. In the Mazda Road to Indy, Zach Veach takes the victory at the Milwaukee Mile, and Spencer Piggott returns to victory lane and extends his championship lead. In Rally, we will preview the Rally Germany and all of the Hinkelsteins, Panzerplatte, and all of those wonderful things. We'll also preview Rally America's Ojibwe Forest Rally and the GRC's Daytona event. This is Open Paddock. And welcome everybody. Good evening. We have an interesting crew with us today. Mr. Weitzel is buried under work, and so he has left us in control of all the buttons. I have with me tonight, I have Mr. John Olsikowski from Houston. Say hello, John.
Hello, John.
And we have Mr. Michael Shaw from beautiful God's country over in Oregon.
Good evening, everybody.
And we have the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Peter Portante of Arms Up Motorsports. Peter, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always entertaining, for sure.
So, we got
to
do.
Well, I need to say a little something. If, okay. If we're a little giggly and all that, it's because we're, you know, well imbibed. As it took Doug a little while to get on the show tonight. So.
Yeah, I'm. I am technically challenged today. I feel like Lewis Hamilton. All my shit keeps breaking on me. I'm surprised my laptop hasn't caught on fire. Grief. And so, yeah, I'm only halfway into my first Manhattan. Yeah, I don't even have a full drink in me yet. Mr. Shaw, what are you enjoying?
I am enjoying a wonderful Crater Lake gin martini.
Ooh, that's a different gin for you.
It is. It's one of the local distilleries. They're based out of Bend there, and it's delicious, actually. Not quite the bite to it, and not as junipery and whatnot as, say, that spruce gin that I was talking about from Rogue. This one's definitely more one that you could mix with and all that stuff. It still has a good flavor to it.
Okay.
So just a little bit more mild and just a wonderful drink, yeah.
Nice. Mr. Olsikowski.
Gee, I have a glass of water.
Nice. Some fine H2O.
Well, you know, you're down there in Houston because you just sweat it all back out again. You got to just keep replenishing.
Right. Yeah. I thought about going all technical and going with the dihydrogen oxide, but...
Hey, that stuff's dangerous.
Yeah, I know.
Too
much everywhere.
That stuff will kill you. Peter, what is in your beverage container this evening?
I'm drinking a water that bubbles in it because, you know, high tech.
Ooh, sparkling. So we have Mr. Portante with the sparkling water and Mr. Olsikowski with the still water.
It was sparkling water. It just went flat.
Oh, okay.
It took Doug that long to get on the show.
It was first one, then the other. Okay, well, gentlemen, we need to get going. And first up is our unintelligible amalgamation of mixed motorsports media. And you know, this was okay. It's not a shocker that Red Bull recruits talent into their young driver program, right? And Max Verstappen is what's the right word I want to use? He is obviously skilled. He has had some fantastic experience. But I tell you what, talk about being on a fast track to F1 from karting straight into 1 year with GP3. And now, boom, he's going to be at Scuderia Toro Rosso and will be, if things continue on track, will be the youngest driver in Formula One history. Your thoughts? Can this kid reach the pedals? Do they have like blocks? Do they have a telephone book underneath him?
You know, actually, you know, the younger generation is going to be really good at this. I mean, you think about, I mean, it's kind of funny because you got, I mean, just how old is Sebastian Vettel. He's not very old, but one thing that he's being stumped by a little bit is all the damn different control combinations you have to do on these more technical cars with the latest homologation, right? So you get a young driver in there that's used to just playing video games all the time where you're pressing all these separate buttons all the time, you know, could be an advantage.
Well, Peter, what's your take on that?
Oof, I don't know. It's gonna be pretty entertaining to see him in the car. I don't know about the video game the video game idea. Not used to playing, you know, while going 150 miles an hour. But I was kind of interested to see it. Before the announcement with Red Bull got signed, there was a couple articles on that Mercedes was after him and Red Bull was after him, and Mercedes driver development program is one of the best. And it was kind of interesting to me when he signed with Red Bull. I'm like, I wonder what Red Bull offered him. A day later, they're like, oh, he's driving in Formula One next year. I'm like, oh, that's what it was.
That's pretty sweet carrot.
and Bob Barker came out, what's behind door number three? A new car!
Actually, I'd liken that more to be like on Let's Make a Deal. You know, you just hope you don't get the Zonk contract with Marussia or something.
Well, you know, that's it. And I guess Mercedes was after Verstappen as well.
Yeah, it was Mercedes and Red Bull were who they named initially.
Yeah, wow. And so I think Red Bull was trying to
defensive maneuver.
Yeah, yeah.
Get him now,
yeah. Let's get a hold of him and you know, offer it, make him an offer he cannot refuse. And of course, this means Jean-Eric Vergne is out, and the young 20-year-old Kvyat is the seasoned veteran on the team.
Isn't that funny?
Crazy is that.
That is,
you know, two things. Number one, I need to get my daughter a cart quickly. She's going to turn four in a couple of months, and she's behind the curve. The kid's got talent. That's unquestionable. He wouldn't have been tapped if he didn't. What he doesn't have is experience. Yep. And the only way he's going to get experience is if he gets in a seat. Is he ready for a Formula One ride? I don't know. You could argue that some of the drivers that are on the grid now aren't ready.
Maldonado.
Funny how that happened. Always the first name that comes up, isn't it?
Hey, I'm saying, you know. But, you know, is he ready? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. We're going to find out if he's ready come Melbourne next year, I guess.
I don't know. I don't think he'll embarrass himself, but I don't think he's going to pull off a Vettel and win at Monza in the
Oh sport, right
in the Toro
for
Rosso.
Sure he won't. No.
So, at least not with a Ferrari power plant.
Well, that's true. Yeah, heads are rolling at Ferrari, aren't they?
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. So, you know, we heard some more terminations as a result of their poor performance and their poor engine performance. But this coming week we got Spa. It is.
You know, I love a good,
even with
I love
the
a
fact
spa
that
weekend.
Yeah, Spa weekend, nice. You know, as much as, you know, we don't really cover F1 that much, but Spa is something that I will watch because it's freaking Spa, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, seriously.
I don't care what people say about the cars, the way the teams are doing or whatever. I'm still going to watch Spa.
Yeah.
I think it's mandatory.
Here you go. It's kind of like I don't watch NASCAR, but I will watch the Daytona 500. I don't. It's because it's got history and all that, you know?
Yeah. But by the same token, I mean, there's people who won't watch IndyCar except for the Indianapolis 500.
Yep, it's true.
Because of the spectacle and the history and all the other reasons you laid out.
Now, so, if we could just convert those people into watching more, that'd be great. But yeah.
Sure.
So at Spa, who do you have? Who's your favorite Mercedes driver?
Yeah, I was going to say, which Mercedes is going to win?
But no, seriously, do you think a Mercedes will win at Spa? Is their engine strong enough to overcome any other potential advantages someone like Bottas might have?
Well, because it doesn't have
or
as much
Daniel
of the heavy
Ricciardo?
Braking, because it's not just like fast straight and then slam on the brakes, fast straight, slam on the brakes. That was the only issues that I think that the Mercedes really had. They had some issues because their brakes are a little bit lighter weight and therefore had issues with that type of scenario. And I think with this track, you know, being, you know, not so hard on the brakes, I'd be saying it's going to be Hamilton because he was the one that had the brake issues before, especially in Canada.
As long as his car didn't catch on fire.
True.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think I can give it to Hamilton.
Okay. John?
I may as well flip a coin to pick a Mercedes driver. I think it's a toss up, could go either way. But I'll say just to be argumentative with Shaw, I'll say Rosberg. But I think it's a pretty foregone conclusion that one of the Silver Arrows is probably going to win, but there's a lot of other drivers that are so good at Spa that there's the ones that I want to watch. Alonso, Raikkonen, those two specifically are so good at Spa and they know it so well. I want to watch them regardless of whether they're in the back or the front.
Raikkonen usually is interesting to watch, and Alonso is, it's amazing how much performance he can get out of that pig of a car. It really
ridiculous.
Is. Yeah. So, Peter, who do you have up front at the end of the Grand Prix?
I'm going to say it's a Mercedes-powered car, but I'm going to say it's going to be Massa.
You read my mind. And yeah, although I'm not down for it. Yeah. I was going to go with the Williams car as well, but as I kind of hinted at earlier, I'm wondering if maybe Bottas comes away with victory. Massa's been really quick. The Williams car is doing really, really great, but I think Bottas might be the stronger driver.
I saw an article earlier, I think it was a Racer article, talking about just kind of a little blurb about what's going on with the teams during the August break. And somebody with Williams was quoted that the level of success that Williams has experienced, the vast majority of that is because of the driver more than the car itself. I think it says a lot that the Williams team holds both of their drivers, both Massa and Bottas, in very high regard. And it makes me wonder how good is Massa at driving a less than worthy car compared to, say, Alonso, who we know is just ridiculously phenomenal. I'd say if Williams thinks that it's the driver more than the car, maybe he's better at with a lousy car than we think he is.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So anyway, there is Spa for this weekend. We will unpack it next week, as we will with all the wonderful IndyCar racing that's coming up this weekend at Sonoma. And getting into IndyCar. John, did you watch the Milwaukee race?
I did. I did watch the Milwaukee race.
So,
and let's I'm bored.
Really? Really? I must admit, I kind of enjoyed it, but I love Milwaukee. The thing was, I was really pining that I wasn't there. Well,
I'm sure.
A little bit, because I was racing instead, so I wasn't pining too much. Yeah.
Well, I did watch it off the DVR later in the evening, and it was a pretty good race.
It was an okay race. From my standpoint, it was an okay. Well, I think one of the problems is that there's such high expectations on the short ovals, Iowa and Milwaukee, and especially with the finish and all of the drama at the end of the Iowa race, this one was just comparatively lackluster. I wouldn't say it was a bad race. I think it was just didn't live up to maybe my own perceived expectations or races past.
Okay, Peter, did you get a chance to watch it?
I only got to see the first half, but I feel like that was the most interesting part with strategy and seeing willpower go off strategy. Quite interesting as well, especially being at point, which is something we haven't really seen that much season. But obviously they pulled it off. It kind of stinks to see the championship kind of spread out like it did. But it's got an interesting storyline with Will, the guy who's finished second every year his entire life, and Helio, the guy who's won the Indy 500 every year and never won a championship. So it'll be an interesting one.
So
my favorite part of it was the fact, just the way that the tires, that first about three laps when they did a tire change and how and that strategy on when you pitted for new tires to make up ground on that first three, maybe even four laps on those new tires. After that, they all be kind of equalized. But it was really fun to see that when somebody had the grip over everybody else.
Yeah. And, Milwaukee is... It's a challenging place to pass, but it's not an impossible place to pass. But when you have good tires, you just seem to fly relative to everyone else around you. Oh, yeah. And if you've got bad tires, it's like you're dragging a boat anchor. It's like you have a Lotus engine in your car.
Nice.
But anyway, so qualifying, gentlemen, did you catch any of that? How did that shake out?
I was actually surprised by two things. Number one, the poor qualifying by Ryan Hunter-Reay. Started 19th. Obviously, with his hope at defending his championship fight, qualifying at Milwaukee was pretty important. But I was equally surprised at just how just dominating Power's qualifying performance was. Him being up at the up toward the point, that isn't surprising at all. Just how much faster he was than everybody else. It showed me he's hungry. He wants it. He's sick of playing second fiddle.
Yeah.
And he wanted to get up front. He wanted to get maximum points this weekend, and he's going to do whatever it takes to secure a championship.
Yeah, he definitely did all the right things, and it was good to see with qualifying and whatnot. It was also great to see Tony Kanaan right up there too.
Yeah, especially after how lackluster Ganassi was in the first half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Well, moving on from qualifying, let's break down the race. You said that Ryan Hunter-Reay had some issues in qualifying. Well, those issues continued in the race. And I didn't really hear exactly what had happened. They showed the replay, and it didn't look like he hit anything. It just there was a component failure.
Broken suspension. Yep.
And that's it. His day is done. I think at that point, I think his championship is done.
Yeah, and even he admitted to that. And there's a single bump on that course, and I don't know if it was something with his setup or what, but. And it could be that, that specific part, but it's the same part that actually failed him before is what it sounded like in that same same suspension component.
It was rear suspension, I know that, and it was the same thing that failed, it was rear suspension that failed previously as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the same component or not.
Yeah, I could have sworn it was one of the same suspension arms or whatever that failed, but anyway. It's pretty frustrating for him. What was interesting at first when he went from like 19th up to like 5th or something like that. I mean, he moved up in a hurry at first, and everybody's like, okay, here we go. It's on. It very well could be him up there in the front here soon. And then to have the suspension fail later was pretty frustrating.
Well, even after he got up to fifth after, I don't know, it was like the first or second round of pit stops, one of his pit stops was slow for some reason, and he ended up falling back to like 10th or 11th. And that's kind of back where he was running when the suspension failed. And at that point he was trying to make up ground, but after that pit stop that was slow, it almost seemed like there was something wrong then, because he wasn't able to make up positions or put up the same kind of lap times that he was before that pit stop. So I don't know if that had something to do with the suspension part failure, or maybe it was just a bad set of tires, scuffs maybe, who knows. He just was not able to get up to speed like he was previously, and stayed mired there mid pack for the rest of the race until the mechanical failure.
What I had seen was, from what I heard from him, was he was saying that he had felt it going away, and both of his stops in the race were terrible, so slow. So he'd make up all his spots, hit, come back out on track, make up a whole bunch of spots, hit, lose all the spots again. And then you're right, when he was running in 11th, wasn't very quick, and supposedly he felt like it was going as the right rear. He said it was like squatting in the corner, which is a feeling that you really don't want to run Milwaukee.
No.
So must have been pretty nerve-wracking while it was still breaking. But it's terribly unlucky for him to have something like that go twice in a year. I mean, the chances of that are pretty slim.
Well, and I've said this frequently on the show before, but there is no such thing as luck, in my opinion. We think, well, what are the odds of this happening twice? I mean, crazy, right? Well, if the odds are that long on this being a chance failure, then maybe it isn't chance. Is this a indication of a deficit on the team? You know, is this a deficiency in the mechanics and engineering talent?
Well, what's interesting there, though, is that you know, they talked about on the TV program is that you know, all the components are, instead of, you know, back in the day when you know, teams could outsource different parts for the car, right?
Right.
In this case, they're all specific Dallara homologated parts. They're supposed to be all the same and all consistent.
Well,
so the odds, like Peter was saying, are a lot more slim, and it's not necessarily so reliant on the engineering, I think, of specific teams of a part like that failing. I think in this case, it really was a bad luck situation.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Doug, gosh.
Hey, I'm just saying.
I got your back, Peter. It's all right.
I'm just saying, you know, it's a... I'm not keen on coincidence. Something happens once, okay. Something happens twice.
Well, I guess what I would say
I'm starting to look at the same lot of parts. Now that
you could know, be. Maybe a team got, you know, parts, you know, 5, 6, and 7 or whatever that, you know, had some sort of minor defect in them that the machine was recalibrated after that, and the other teams don't see it.
That could be.
This and is so, stuff that happens.
Yeah, and so again, that goes maybe. That goes to
maybe Hinch has a case of sour grapes and he's sabotaging things.
Nice. So Penske finally had it together. Will Power, of course, maxes out the weekend, but Juan Pablo didn't have too bad of a race either.
Definitely, he was fun to watch, especially towards the end of the race, where it seemed like he employed a strategy of just kind of riding for most of the race. He was up near the front and was content to ride, and then when it got down to the end, that's when, you know, he just put his foot down and made his moves, and it was a lot of fun to watch. But he's always fun to watch, isn't he?
You know, the other exciting thing for me, especially towards the end of the race, was watching Joseph Newgarden.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering. Yellow.
Did Newgarden's pit crew switch with
with Ryan Hunter Ray?
Because finally had consistent good pit stops there, and it was great to see. And look what comes out of it. And it really shows the talent of the driver this time, not hampered by issues in the pits.
Well, and let's put it this way: he passed the race leader to unlap himself there in the closing laps of the race.
That was brilliant.
And
too.
In the last lap, he went from 7th to 5th.
Yep.
He passed both Simon Pagenaud and Ryan Briscoe to claim a top 5. I mean, that was a remarkable drive, and even though he did garner a top 5 out of it, I don't think that position really shows the strength and quality of the drive that he put in on Sunday.
No argument.
Peter, what do you think?
I was impressed. I like to see him do well. I mean, he's had such a terrible season, but such a terrible couple of years, to be honest, with really nothing to do with his fault. So, I mean, you can go back to Long Beach this year, too, and just cringe. But it's good. It's a good result for him. Obviously, it sounds like he's going to have teammates on the way soon, and I think they'll really benefit from that. Less about him, I think, more about the team. I think he's been hustling a car that hasn't always been there 100%.
Well, and like we mentioned last week, we've seen him have a car that when the car was capable, he would hemorrhage spots on pit lane, like we saw at Mid Ohio. But it was nice to see everything come together the way it did. So now we look at the championship. Will Power taking max points from Milwaukee, a race he desperately needed as we now go to Sonoma next week. He leads Elio Castroneves by 39 points. He's certainly not out of the danger zone. You know, Archer references notwithstanding.
Danger zone.
But anyway, as we go
into Kenny Loggins, Lana.
Nice.
So as we go to Sonoma, Sonoma's a doubleheader, isn't it?
No.
Am I remembering that it's a one-off?
It's a one-off.
Okay.
The only doubleheaders are at street.
Or the street courses. That's right.
Or parking lots.
Right.
Yeah. Where the autocrosses.
Right.
You know, I'm glad you got a home racer in Houston, but they should have just set up cones and had done with it. So we have the race at Sonoma and then the double points race at Fontana. How critical is it for Power to pad that lead at Sonoma before going to Fontana, where Elio is going to be strong?
You know, is it critical? I don't think it's critical, but I know he damn well wants to, because he knows how strong Elio will be at Fontana. Honestly, with the double points at Fontana, it's barring a mishap by, you know, Power and possibly Castroneves, it's pretty much a crapshoot, and whoever's going to win and take max points that weekend is going to have a huge jump in standings. You know, so pull out your percentile and roll them.
Nice. So should we even be talking about Pagenaud and Hunter Ray at this point?
I don't think so.
Are they far enough back that that even with the double points at Fontana, are they realistically within striking distance? Not mathematically, but realistically?
At this point, realistically, yes. Unless one of them just blows Sonoma out of the water, and does like maybe does what Power did at Milwaukee and gets the pole and wins the race, possibly.
And most laps they, led and all that, right?
Well, there's no points for most laps led, is there?
No, not.
Oh, sorry,
not in IndyCar.
Thinking the other one.
Yeah, there are for I think for Peter, help me out. Isn't there bonus points for most laps?
I don't think there's bonus points.
Oh, it's fastest lap.
Most laps.
Fastest lap.
Fastest is one. But they're like 1 point. So in the grand scheme of things, it's double points.
Yeah, minimal.
In the finale, it's almost meaningless, yeah.
Yeah, especially at this stage.
So
are the for the finale, are the point gaps between positions double as well?
How do you mean?
Like if it's 10 points, because it's like 10 points difference versus like if it was 10 points different from first to second, is it 20 for the double header, or do they all do the whole point system differently?
No,
I think it's just double points for every position. Yeah,
right, for every position.
Yeah, so P1 pays 100, P2 pays 80. So yep. Instead of there being a 10-point differential, there is a 20-point differential between first and second.
You know, I think Pagenaud would definitely have to come out winning at Sonoma for him to still be a factor. But yeah, and he's good there, but I don't think the odds are against it, and it's really just between Castroneves and Power.
You know, Ryan Hunter-Reay is only 16 points back behind Pagenaud. You could make the same case if Ryan Hunter-Reay were to knock Sonoma out of the park too. It would be reasonable to factor him into the championship, the realistic championship picture.
And Will Power has known to choke at Fontana. So, but although he's, you know, significantly better on ovals now than he used to be, but
oh yeah, his oval racecraft has improved by leaps and bounds in the last
exactly.
So, all right, we're still looking at a Penske duel with an outside chance of Pagenaud and even Ryan Hunter-Reay, although unlikely. They're going to have to close the gap at Sonoma. So going back to Milwaukee and thinking about things, the crowd at the venue, when you saw it on TV.
What crowd?
Well, no. Hang on. I've seen it with a lot less people.
That really?
Yes.
You know, from the TV, it really kind of depended on the camera shot.
Right.
If you had a wide shot where they were kind of panning as they were coming down the front stretch into turn one, you saw the grandstands that are kind of at the end, and they were mostly empty.
Completely empty.
Oh yeah, the grandstands in the middle were fine, but the grandstand
in the middle looked. There were people in them. How full they were as far as a percentage, I really couldn't get a gauge. The one quote as far as attendance estimate I saw was a Racer article by Robin Miller, and he said it was about 18,000.
Yeah, Peter, were you there?
I was not there. I wish I was, but no, I was not.
Okay. And, you know, I'll buy the 18,000, 20,000 number. That jives with, I was looking at some of the photos from Paul Hurley, his race start photos with the crowd and all that. And that sounds like a reasonable number. And that is about what we had last year. It seemed like it might have been a little bit better than last year, but marginally. The infield was really hopping a lot more than last year was. From talking to some people who were there, Steve Wittich, for example. And
but last year there was the issue of rain. I think it was on race day.
Yes.
In the morning, and then it cleared up by green flag time, but that would have put a damper on walk-up attendance at least.
You know, I don't know how much I would like to see a breakdown of advance purchase versus walk-up purchase. I would bet that the walk-up ticket sales at an IndyCar event is pretty minimal, and that the vast majority of tickets are advance purchase, pre-purchase. But the thing we have to ask is Milwaukee sustainable? It's going to be back next year, which is a good thing. So I think Milwaukee is a great venue, and it's a good race. It's good. It's a good market for us but in the years forward, is this really sustainable? I mean, 18 is about what, a little less than that, about 15 is what Kansas had in 2010 in its final year before they just packed it in.
Was the marketing campaign very good for this?
The article that I read, the Miller article, said that there were locals that were saying that promotion was good, at least local promotion was good. There was a buzz throughout the city. People knew about the event and that sort of thing. As far as external promotion, I couldn't tell you.
Well, what about pricing?
Well, when I went there a couple years ago, the pricing was quite reasonable.
Okay.
Andretti Marketing does Andretti Promotions, pardon me, really does a good job.
They
put together a good product. And so I'm not sure what to make of this number. I mean, it's a good race. Yeah, you don't have the luxury boxes, but that's not who's going to pack the stands. Is this something indicative of IndyCar? Is this something indicative of motorsport? I mean, so we've been seeing NASCAR numbers fall as well.
Well, I guess the question is, what is the desired race attendance? What is IndyCar's desired race attendance? How many fans do they want to see? Oh, obviously they want to see as many as can fit in there.
Sold out crowd.
From their standpoint,
what number are they going to consider it a successful event, or is that left up to the track promoter? As far as what attendance is going to constitute the event being successful or not. In my mind, 18,000 people at Milwaukee is kind of barely there. I wouldn't really consider that successful necessarily, maybe adequate.
Yeah.
But nothing better than that.
So, this gets to a larger question. When we look at promotion, who is responsible for promotion? Who takes the blame when you do have an unfortunate, like Pocono, for example. Pocono had a disastrous turnout. Right. And, there's been a lot of talk. Did the track do enough to promote? And the track is saying, well, where's IndyCar in promoting this event as well? IndyCar, as much as we may love it, it's not big enough to just say, pay us the money, we'll bring our circus, and it's your responsibility to sell tickets. And, like Bernie can command. And quite honestly, Bernie doesn't care if there's a single person at the track, so long as the
he got the money.
So long as people are watching on TV, right?
Yeah. But
IndyCar didn't have the TV numbers either, and so does IndyCar itself share some of the responsibility and culpability for getting fans to the track and not having an unfortunate turnout like we had at Milwaukee?
Yes,
definitely.
I think IndyCar is responsible. I think that the individual or the group that's promoting the individual event is responsible. In this case, Andretti. I hate to use business buzzwords, but there has to be a synergy there between the track or the event promoter and the series. Because the series wants to promote itself. They want to promote their entire season and all of their races as a package, and the track promoter wants their race highlighted. If people don't know about the series, then they're not going to know about the individual races. It's so they both have to work together to promote the event. And to be quite honest, I think that that's been one of the issues that IndyCar has had is all of the finger pointing. The event promoters are pointing at IndyCar saying, well, you're not promoting our events. And IndyCar is pointing at the event promoter saying, well, you're not promoting your events. Well, they're probably both right.
Yeah. Yep. I'm completely agreement with Oskowski here.
Well, and Peter, this isn't exactly apples to apples type comparison. But Mr. Anderson, Dan Anderson, does a pretty good job of really selling his, well, now three series, ownership of Pro Mazda and USF 2000, and operations of Indy Lights. Do you see much of what he does from the inside that maybe IndyCar could learn from?
I mean, it's a little bit different marketing-wise for us, is we're trying to always kind of, the biggest marketing thing for us is not necessarily, you know, people in the stands or,
right.
We kind of pretty much, we're at IndyCar. So IndyCar is IndyCar can't sell itself, essentially, but IndyCar can sell us, and that's pretty much the whole marketing thing for the Mazda Road to Indy. And a lot of the big thing for us is trying to get, what the drivers is, Dan is trying to do more and more, getting drivers from overseas and from karting into series. So you see a lot of scholarship opportunities, stuff like that. So it's more on a driver's front that, you know, we see a lot of stuff going on in the Mazda Road to Indy, kind of like, you know, Indy Lights has a scholarship now to IndyCar. So from the driver's front, it's obviously quite hard to get into IndyCar. So, you know, you see a lot of, you don't see many rookies, that is for sure. Although you have three this year, which is quite good. But it's tough. I mean, it's not very easy to get a paid ride, and it's really expensive to pay for your ride. So it's a tough boat to sail, that's for sure.
Well, you know, one of the things that, as I look at his leadership, and like I said, you know, I know it's not a direct type of comparison, but when you look at how Mr. Anderson approaches, it doesn't seem to me that he has the opinion that teams, it's on you and only on you to attract drivers, get her done. I'm going to be over here, because that's the attitude that IndyCar seems to have with the tracks, right? But he sees it seems like he sees it the whole marketing and promotion of the series as a partnership between he and his organization and the teams working together towards that common goal of recruiting people in and making the series successful. And it seems like it's that type of attitude that maybe is missing, not just on the IndyCar side, but also on the track promoters side. That I don't know, you know, I don't know you can if there's one side that started it or the other or what, but there just seems to be a failure to exist in partnership, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, sure. thinking about the way that IndyCar and the teams, the team owners specifically, have been bickering, I wonder if it's just a case of IndyCar not wanting to play well with others across the board in any capacity.
You have to wonder how many team owners are still living in the 80s and 90s from not back true. In the heyday. I don't know. But anyway, so we could jabber on about that.
I will say this: if they came to Portland, they'd probably get more than 20,000 people in the stands. Just saying.
Yeah, well, that's what they said about New England. That's what they said.
They get it in Alabama.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see him give it a shot. I'd like to see him go back to PIR. It'd be fantastic. The Pro Mazda races at PIR were amazing. I remember seeing Ardoin Edwards duking it out up there at PIR, and it's fantastic stuff. So at Milwaukee, we heard of a new merger. Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing, which was already a merger between Sarah Fisher and Hartman Oil, is going to merge with Ed Carpenter Racing.
This is freaking brilliant.
It is. It really is. So we're going to have CFH Racing, Carper Fisher Hartman Racing, and it's not going to be. They're not merging to a single car. It's like they're taking kind of both programs and putting them under one roof. And I think this will really help out Newgarden if he decides to stay. He hadn't signed his contract yet, right?
I thought that was interesting that he didn't sign the contract yet. Although sometimes that means just I'm trying to get more money, but could also mean that there's other teams that are looking at him. This is still a great opportunity. First of all, if you look at the teams joining together, if you remember Ed Carpenter Racing, I don't recall any pit stop issues ever with that team, so some cross training could happen there. But aside from that, it's a great merger, and the potential maybe they could save enough money because you're joining forces, and the fact that you're only going to need maybe a few less parts for maintaining the cars and all that stuff, right? Because you're gonna be able to, you're not gonna need quite as many tools and equipment and whatnot. So you kind of merge that together to maybe save some of the costs. What was very interesting is seeing one J.R. Hildebrand with Fuzzy's vodka hat hanging out at the pits there in Milwaukee. And if he joined in as a third car,
he's probably not going to join in as a third car, because remember, Conway is off to WEC with Toyota, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so I think you may see Hildebrand take over the role that Conway is playing now, and that would be a great, great fit. Advantage to this merger that I see for both sides is more data. And Peter, you can probably speak to this. Working on a team with multiple cars as opposed to being off by yourself, and being able to kind of beat some ideas against your teammates I don't know how much data sharing that you do at Arms Up or did last year at Bilardi, but more data has got to be more better.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you definitely. I've been very fortunate this year to have a really good teammate with Aaron, and we both drive two completely different ways. So if we weren't teammates, we would both be looking for time essentially in the wrong places. So it's good to see where one person's strong and where the other person's strong, and you can really, it's cliche, but you can each figure out your strengths and weaknesses. And that's kind of for me, to the single car teams in IndyCar and even Mazda at the Indy, and see them be successful is quite impressive to me, just because they're working with a lot less, even if it doesn't seem like it. But it's going to be good for the team. I think Joseph, has a lot of seat time in the car and has a pretty good idea with data, but it's going to be good for the team. They're both smaller teams. So I think some of them, they've gotten to tracks where they figured it out, when they've gone to other tracks where they haven't figured it out. And if Sarah Fisher or Ed has one figured out and one doesn't, I think that's going to be only positive for the future.
Yeah, that's the real big takeaway I see is more cooperation, more data. Especially for Newgarden, this is going to be, if he stays, I think this will really help elevate him up into that that top tier of competitiveness.
There's other parts of this that are a lot more intangible too. Let's not forget Ed Carpenter got his first win in an IndyCar driving for Sarah Fisher.
That's right. At Kentucky. And
they are friends. Despite being, competitors on the track or, in the team owner suites or whatever. I think that their friendly relationship will make them as partners on a team be able to operate a little bit better. Plus, they've both been in the car. They understand the perspective of, how different it is when you put that helmet on and can relate to that and coincide that with the engineering and all of the data that you were talking about and all the other facets of a race team, the administration stuff and all of that. I think that because of Ed and Sarah's friendship and the way that they interact with one another, I think it's going to make it that much stronger a team. And it wouldn't surprise me if out of the gate coming next year, they were a force to be reckoned with.
True. And yeah. One of the forces that they'll have to be dealing with next year is Ryan Hunter Ray. He finally signed with Andretti, re-upping for re-upping for 2014. And DHL, more importantly, is also re-up for 3 years with the Andretti squad. And so, you know, I used to be a huge RHR fan. Lacking on that lately, but it is good to see him continue at Andretti because he is a strong driver and he does give the Andretti squad a strong chance at a championship, even if it's a bit of a long shot this year.
What I will say about real quick about the Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing Carpenter Racing merger is what's cool to see is a merger that everybody's all for instead of, oh, they're having a merger because somebody's losing something. This is a win-win, and you just don't see that very often.
Yeah.
All right, well, moving on, some exciting things. As a geek, this really has me excited. This is what I've been saying should happen for a very long time. You know, we finally get Aero kits. What, 3 years late, right?
Yeah.
But, okay, better late than never. But this is the really cool thing. It looks like there's going to be areas of the Aero kits that are going to be allowed to be developed over the course of the season.
Interesting.
And you know, the thing is, how much of the car that can be modified is pretty significant. The nose structure, which is integral to the crash structure of the car, you can't change that.
Right. And the whole tub, you know, basically that whole area kind of is blocked off, right?
Well, the cockpit is.
Right.
Okay. The cockpit and the underwing are set. The full front wing is open for development. The side pods, the rear wing, the rear bumper elements, the engine cover, all of that is fair game.
Ooh.
All of that is fair game. Now the intakes, of course, have to remain where they are. Okay, or not the airbox and the crash, you know, the roll structure, that's part of the safety cell. The radiator intakes are spec. They must be where they are. But there really is a lot of development that you can do. And you're not going to be able to develop everything mid-season. It's pretty much the wing elements. You can develop the end plates and the trailing. You can modify the trailing element, the upper element of the rear wing. The main plane is fixed, as is the main plane on the front wing. But the secondary and tertiary elements, as well as the end plates on the front wing, are also open for mid-season development. So this could be really, really cool. Now, you know, you got to ask the question, is there enough money in IndyCar for this? But, you know, I got to say, I don't think you can ask that economics type of question or, you know, that short-term question. I think you really have to look at this as, you know, one way that we're going to move forward is to get back to what we were doing when IndyCar Kart was insanely successful. And that is allowing teams to develop have different looking cars, interesting cars, trying out interesting things. Because then, well, like in Formula One, we know about the engine designers, the aerodynamicists. We know names like Adrian Newey, right? And so when kids are looking at motor car racing, they can see, hey, you know, driving is very cool. But there's a lot of other things you can do and be involved in motor car racing as well. And I'm really excited about this.
I am too. What I want to know is when Randy Bernard first proposed the idea of the aero kits to produce different looks and different, potentially different branding for the cars, he envisioned external companies,
Boeing.
One of the names he tossed out, Boeing, GE, yeah. You know, and some of the other companies that would have a that would have some interest or something to gain from designing, creating an aero kit for an IndyCar. I'm sure most, if not all of that, has kind of been swept under the rug at this point. But do the rules still allow for an outside or an independent designer to create an aero kit and sell it to teams?
Yeah.
Not necessarily a Chevy, not necessarily a Honda or a Dallara, but, you know, Joe's IndyCar Aero Kits Inc.
Yeah, that's still there. Dallara was actually going to build an aero kit too for the new aero kit, but they decided not to. So it's pretty much going to be Chevys and Hondas. But yeah, that's still open for companies to do. And there's been building some interest from some companies. I forgot the names, to be honest, but so it might be something in 2016. But Honda came out with an article saying there's a lot more room than people think for the aero kit. So you might see a lot of diversity just between the Hondas and the Chevys.
Well, I don't know who was supplied that. I think it might have been Weitzel that shared that. It actually shows the areas of the car that have the potential to be designed, and it blew me away. I didn't think that they would have opened it up as much as IndyCar has.
I'm telling you, blows me away. You know, and
I think they're doing it the right way financially too. I mean, with the teams doing, not the teams making the aero kits, but you know, manufacturers are outsourcing the job essentially for aero. I think it's good because it keeps costs down for the team, which is the biggest thing. So I mean, you're putting where the money is being, you know, where you have to put down the money is being spent by the people with the money, which is the manufacturers.
One thing that I'm surprised we haven't seen is some sort of an open source design. I don't know if you've heard of, I forget his name, but it's the company is Perrin, I believe it is. And they're doing that sort of a model with an LMP1 car, basically a ground up design that the design elements are crowdsourced. For people who participated in this, submit design ideas or specific design elements, some of which are more aesthetic based, some of which are engineering based, but put all of those together and some of those elements are going to be viable to include on their car. It surprises me that nobody's tried to do something similar to design an IndyCar aero kit.
I'm really skeptical of that model. And I'll tell you why. You know,
it's all public. Yeah.
You know, and it's not that. It's easy to draw up something that looks really cool.
Sure.
Fluid dynamics. Fluids are tricky, tricky things. They do some really weird stuff. And so, you know, to properly design an aero bit.
I think we talked about this on the show a little bit before. It was like, there's a reason why a lot of the modern super efficient like cars on the road look like a Prius.
Well,
because computational fluid dynamics states that that's the lowest drag coefficient you're going to get in a design.
Sure. Right.
But, I mean, you know, okay, we're not going to all have race cars that look like Priuses. You know, when we look at...
No, they actually need some drag downforce.
No, but what I'm saying is, you know, you're not going to converge to a singularity of style. But to do that design work, you've got to have some pretty mad, you know, vector calculus skills. You've got to have some pretty robust computer hardware. It's not something that is going to lend itself well to crowdsourcing is the point.
I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I see the folly or the potential folly of that sort of a model. But it just seems to me from the standpoint of if there are enough fans of sports car racing, specifically prototypes, that would get involved in a project to design a car from the ground up, a crowdsourced or open source type of design like that, I would think that there would be a similar fan base that would want to be involved in an IndyCar project.
But is there a team IndyCar that would want them to be involved?
Well, that's true too. That's another thing. But if it's just an aero kit, what would be the harm of if people wanted to in their spare time design an aero kit and try to make something viable and then try to sell it to teams?
Yeah,
because that's essentially what people are doing with this LMP1 car. This isn't their job. This is their spare time. This is their weekend hobby or whatever. I would think that there would be groups or pockets of fans that would be interested in doing that.
I think there would be, you know, there's the IndyCar fan base is an extremely knowledgeable fan base.
Sure.
Compared to, you know, compared to some other sports. And so I don't doubt that the skill and resources might be out there, but I still have a hard time seeing it. I really do. However, I do think that you might see some partnership develop, where, you know, Honda, Chevy come out with a kit, early on, and then maybe mid season, someone like Boeing or another, you know, some other type of company comes in and assists in the revision and development.
Instead of Chevy versus Honda, can we have Boeing versus Airbus?
Versus Lockheed Martin? Yeah, there you go.
Ooh, you know who
not
you
Air Malaysia?
To? Yeah, not Air Malaysia.
Too soon, maybe.
Where'd Dale Coyne's number 18 Air Malaysia car go? Nobody knows.
Ouch.
Penske shot it down as it entered his pit space. Okay, too soon. So, Sonoma.
Unfortunately, Sonoma. If Air Malaysia did an aero design, it'd be the only one that actually stays in the air.
That's right. That's right.
Forever and ever.
Wait, did they design the Mercedes C9 at Le Mans?
There you go.
Ooh, wow. Well played, sir. Well played.
So, Sonoma, we've talked about this a little bit, and who has to do well for the championship. But let's think about it. Who will do well? And do you think the crowd will do well?
You know who I want to see, especially after last year. I want to see Bourdais, because he crashed out relatively early last year, and was on a bit of a tear when that happened. Who will do well? Man, talking about a NASCARized road course, it could be anybody.
No, they're not using the NASCAR road course.
Yeah,
no, but the design of the circuit is such that it's still very, still, you know, lots of wide areas, lots of paved runoff that's specifically done to accommodate the, you know, stock cars. So
I'm partial to Scott Dixon here.
Yeah,
Scott Dixon's a good pick.
Sonoma has a lot of similarities to Mid-Ohio. In that you've got those really big elevation changes, some mm-hmm. blind apexes, very challenging technical sports car type course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I really like your notion of Scott Dixon, and I'm going to go with that. I think you're right. I think he takes the win. I think Ryan Hunter-Reay has another disappointing race. You know, some gremlin will befall him yet again. And Elio, I think, will not have the race that he wants to have. I think we're going to see Power and Dixon fight it out for the top spot.
I would agree that that's probably a fair assessment.
But will Power work it in the pits?
No.
No.
Because, boy, he's had a lot of pit speed violations and other issues.
He has, but I think he and the team have that under control now, I think.
Of course, I guess you don't go into the pits at such a high speed there. You're coming off a hairpin, so never mind.
Right, right. So, Peter?
I think it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be pretty tough to beat Will, you know, especially off how good he did there last year. But it was an all-Canassi front row last year, wasn't it? So that'll be interesting as well. I think Dixon's going to be an interesting player just for the fact of I think he's going to be splitting Helio and Will Power in the last two races. It's just going to be interesting in which order because the point gaps are quite big, actually, for being a position or two apart. So I think that's going to play the biggest factor of all of this.
So moving away from IndyCar, in addition to IndyCar, the lights and, well, in fact, I think everybody is going to be at Sonoma, right? For the Mazda Road to Indy, this is the grand finale for Lights, Pro Mazda, and USF 2000. But before we get to Sonoma, and even before we get to Milwaukee, Peter, we've got to talk about Mid-Ohio. We didn't get a chance to last week. And you had two-thirds of a great weekend at Mid-Ohio. You had two great race results, two podiums. Let's focus on those two first. Tell us about race number one, race number two. Both of those were in the dry.
I think our weekend was all quite a bit backwards when you go into a little bit of detail. We qualified third, 0.005 of a second off pole, so the top three were pretty damn close. So race one started, it was really good conditions, the car was working really well. We had a good start, but not as good as Daniel Burkett, who went from I have no idea where to second in one lap, which was unbelievable. Unfortunately, I could not get by him for the entire race. So I got stuck behind him until it started raining, actually, in the last five laps, and then I was able to get by him and get third. But when we got a little bit of a gap when we were behind Daniel, we were running laps quicker than the two guys in front, so it was a little bit unfortunate. It was good to get the podium, but we had so much pace in the car that, you know, to fight for a win makes it kind of a little bit disappointing, but it was a really good battle with Daniel. He's always fun to drive with. He's pretty aggressive, but not overly, maybe a little bit overly, but it's entertaining. We both drive pretty aggressive, so I can't complain too much. Then in race three, it was pretty much the opposite of that. I started third again, had a pretty good start, got up to second, and was able to hold off RC, but the car was a handful. After like the second lap, it was insanely no grip. I was just sideways everywhere, and I came into the pit lane after the race, and the team said something that I'd never heard before. They said, "Congratulations, and we're sorry."
Oh, wow. Wow. What? So was it a setup thing or a suspension thing or was it tire pressures?
They're like, "Oh, yeah, we didn't let down the tires at all. You kind of just went on whatever." I'm like, that's why I was so quick on the second lap of the race.
Oh, no.
Okay, so, well, there you are then.
Yeah, so it was a hard-fought second, probably it deserved more third, and then in the rain, kind of all swung around to the other side, I got hit on the pace lap, and I got a flat, but I didn't know I got a flat. I pretty much just went, I felt a little bump in the back, I'm like, what an idiot, I'm driving, and then the first long left-hander into the carousel on the first lap, the car squatted, and I said, "Oh, no," and then went into the grass and came back out. I'm like, "Oh, the track must be a lot more slick than I thought it was. I just made a stupid mistake on the first lap." And then into the next corner, into turn one, I went off again. I'm like, "Something is not right." And then on the last lap, the tire actually shredded, and I just pretty much limped into pit lane on the last lap. So it was pretty unfortunate,
shredded,
but it was still like...
That shredded back on... did that happen in Thunder Valley?
Yeah, it happened into, exactly. Pretty much, I kind of went straight into China Beach.
Okay. Oh, yes. Because I was, where was I then? I think I was down near the Honda Bridge at that point. So I missed you, going in because I was elsewhere on track. As always, it seemed like every time there was some argy-bargy, I was elsewhere. And I had just been in the area where the action had happened like 3 minutes ago. Oh, well.
Timing.
Yeah, that was the theme of that weekend for me. But hit on the how do you hit somebody on the pace lap?
I have no idea. I mean, everyone's warming up brakes. I mean, I don't want to give anyone an excuse or anything. It was really tough to see, but it sucks. It really does. Pretty unfortunate. But
and no mea culpa from anyone afterwards. No one came up to you and said, "Hey, my bad. I'm sorry."
I think that was the smartest move because I really don't know who it was. So I was just kind of people like, "Who hit you?" And I would name off like three or four drivers that were near me. So,
all of them.
I don't really know. Victor seemed to be kind of a wrecking ball in that race, so it could have been him. He was starting two spots behind me, and then Daniel was behind me too. So, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, that's racing. It's really nobody's fault, but it's unfortunate. It just seems to be the way our season's gone this year. It's been a trying year, but we're probably leading practice points, which is the most important thing.
There you go. And of course, you get the biggest trophies ever for winning practice, right?
Yeah, it's what all the team owners in IndyCar look at, so I'm happy about that.
Well, as we go to Sonoma, like I mentioned, Sonoma is, of course, a lot like Mid-Ohio in terms of the terrain, the elevation change and the nature, the flowy nature of some of the corners. Difficult to pass, you really have to pick your spots. You did well at Mid-Ohio. Are you optimistic about Sonoma?
I really am. I think you know, it's so close to Mid-Ohio that the car setups are going to be quite similar. So we're going to be looking for a really strong result right out of the box. We got a good amount of practice, too. We have 3 sessions of practice, which is going to be nice. Not many people have been there. I think the only team that's ever been there in these cars is Jay, who tested there last season, actually. So it's going to be a really good fight, I think. We're going to see what happens, but we should be right up at the top of the field and hopefully bring home a couple wins at the end of the season.
Oh, excellent. Fantastic. Well, let's go to Milwaukee for a second and think about the races. And let's start with Indy Lights. First of all, can't imagine how excited I was after getting home from Lincoln after 2 days of racing autocrossing on 50 acres of Cold War concrete at Lincoln Air Park. Oh wow, was that amazing! They used the Nationals, they rebuilt the Nationals course from last season, and it was fun and it was exhausting. But I finally get home Sunday night, and I look at the DVR and I'm like, oh, outstanding! I've got both the IndyCar race and the Indy Lights race. Hell's yes. So I'll watch the IndyCar race. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good race. And then I'm like, okay, let's watch the Indy Lights race. Golf. What must be the end of golf? Let me fast forward a little bit. More golf. I'm like, are you kidding? They did it to me again.
Twice this year.
Yeah, and so yep. I didn't get to see the Indy Lights race at all. You know, I heard the results. Heard that Zach Beach won from pole. Good on him. It's his third win of the season, and I believe it's his first win on an oval, and so outstanding for Zach. He reclaims P2 from Harvey, but Chavez had a time of it, and Matthew Brabham really poured it on after kind of a lackluster season. He comes up in P2. Did any of you guys catch the race, watch it on live timing and scoring, or were you victims of being golfified as well?
I was a victim of, I was golfified too. I caught portions of it through timing and scoring, and the bits that I saw made it look like it was the Zach Veach show. So.
Well, that's really what it sounded like to me from some of the occasional tweets that I would see and some of the quick recaps that I read. Peter, did you get to watch any of it?
No, but when I read a little bit of the reviews, it actually seemed to be quite a good run. Kind of similar to the Mazda race, a kind of a late restart changed everything up, and I guess Brabham was leading for a little bit, and Veach got him on the end of a restart, so tough for Matty B, but good result for Veach, you know, to get a win. He's kind of been had a strong beginning of the season, kind of set it to falter a little bit, so it'll be good for his championship for sure.
Yeah, it certainly closes down significantly. We're looking at, 7 points now between Veach and Chavez. And, you know, Harvey isn't completely out of the running. He's 23 points behind Chavez. And so it's not out of the question that Harvey pulls it off, especially with a doubleheader. They're gonna run two at Sonoma, just like you all in F2000. Does he have a real chance at overtaking Gabby or Zach? Can he put it off back to back wins like he did at Mid Ohio?
I mean, I think he could. I mean, he really has the chance. But the thing is, too, is I think Gabby's got enough of a gap on him where it's not gonna really play that much into it. I think he's going to close up, and I think it's going to make the second race at Sonoma quite interesting, but I think it's always going to be Gabby's show. I mean, I think the biggest thing to look at the championship, to be honest, to see if Veach keep too, because Harvey's going to be right there. I mean, like we said, Sonoma's pretty similar to Mid-Ohio, so it's going to be really good for the Schmidt cars, because Harvey was essentially untouchable at Mid-Ohio.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm going to say it's not so much for the Schmidt cars, because Juan Pablo and Juan Petrohedra, they're okay drivers, but they're not going to be challengers for podiums by any stretch. Luis Razia, he's inconsistent. And so of the Schmidt guys, I think Harvey's your man. And yeah, Mid-Ohio was absolutely the Jack Harvey show. And everybody else was just getting sloppy seconds. You know, I think that they're, because of how similar the tracks are and how strong Harvey was at Mid-Ohio, if they come, if they unload off the trailer well, and you know they're not trying to chase the car through the various practices, you know they come off quick. That I think Harvey does have a chance, not just to take over second from Veach, but really close up on Chavez. And if Chavez has, you know, weird things happen. You just look at the Indy Grand Prix weekend, when both Chavez and Veach had two disastrous races. I think it's only going to take one bad race, one unfortunate mistake. And, you know, all of a sudden, this becomes a lot tighter than anyone expected. I think Chavez certainly is in the driver's seat. It's his championship to lose, but he can't just kind of play the prevent defense, to use a football analogy, since we're in preseason. You know, he's still got to race for that win. But I think it's going to be a little tighter than some people may expect.
I could definitely see that. I mean, I feel like Gabby's deserved championship. You know, I think he's doing really good for, you know, Brian, who's, you know, finally leading a lights championship after what's been a couple inches years for him. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of thinking way ahead now, where, you know, hopefully Gabby gets something in IndyCar. But it's so tight and so tough to get into that group that it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, there's so few seats. I mean, he'll have, if he wins the championship, he'll have some scholarship money. Well, we saw Sage Karam had some scholarship money too.
Well, unfortunately, the way it works for lights is you have to do the whole season to be able to use it.
Or the 500, right?
Yeah. That's getting into the newer, the 2015 lights scholarship is different than this one.
Okay.
This one is, it's $1 million. Which sounds like a lot.
Pretty quick.
That's enough, maybe, to convince someone to take a look at you for Indianapolis.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And it may be put together a 3-race deal, you know, for some select other races during the season. But it's certainly not enough to land a full time gig. But you know, there's not a lot of empty seats in IndyCar. It's tough.
Like, well, none.
True.
Yeah. But you
following light history, though, it'll probably be whoever finishes second in the championship will get the IndyCar ride, and then Gabby will be in a sports car.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And up in sports car, sure.
So let's look at Pro Mazda at Milwaukee. Normally, you know, I have to admit, the Pro Mazdas on an oval usually is not that exciting of a show. You know, unless you're looking at someplace small and flat, like Lucas Oil Raceway. I remember at Iowa, and the last time I was at Milwaukee, you had about the first 5 laps. There was all kinds of action, and it was exciting. And then it settles down by about lap 10, and then you just circulate, because the cars are really kind of at the top end of what, you know, what they're capable of speed-wise, and there's a lot more grip than there is horsepower available at the kind of at that point, it seems like.
Pin the throttle and steer.
Well, yeah, and so, you know, but Milwaukee is unique, right? It is extremely flat, and this year's race seemed to be quite filled with excitement. Again, I didn't get a chance even to follow along timing and scoring. Did any of you happen to pick that up? Peter, did you follow the Pro Mazda race?
Unfortunately, I didn't follow it live. Followed a lot of the information afterward, and I think a lot of it had to do with qualifying was actually ended up being pretty screwy for some reason. So,
well, it wasn't like the truck race where only one person actually finished a lap.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
That was great.
I heard something about it, not all this.
Oh, this is why I don't watch the NASCAR trucks. What a circus. But anyway, so Pro Mazda qualified.
Yep. Qualifying was Spencer was in about sixth, and I think Scott was seventh. Jose Gutierrez was on a pole. Nicholas Costa was second. Kaiser was third. So it was like almost like in stock car racing when they reversed the grid after qualifying. So it ended up being an interesting show for sure, with a lot of the faster guys who had been leading practice kind of coming up from the back, and the guys in the front pretty much doing all they can to stay there.
And there was a lot of movement during the race, and a few restarts certainly helped with that.
Oh, true. I mean, it went down pretty much to the last lap, you know, with Spencer and Spencer and Scott. It was the last restart that got Spencer around Scott and vice versa. So it was a good battle. Obviously, that extends Spencer's point lead, but it was good to see both of them go at it, you know, head to head.
And you know, it is interesting that now we look at Piggott. Back in victory circle, place he hadn't been for a long time, and like I said, that extends his lead. He's got what, 29 points up? I'm sorry, 19 points up on Hargrove now. And so two races to go. Hargrove has really, I think, been better on the road courses here at the last half of the season. Should Piggott be concerned?
I mean, Spencer's been really quick on the road courses, but something else happened on the road courses at Mazda. Everyone else picked up. I mean, at Mid-Ohio, Spencer and Scott were running 6th and 7th between each other, so it's really going to be,
yeah.
I think, kind of like IndyCar. It's going to be the other cars playing a bigger deal in the championship than more than just Scott and Spencer. It's not going to be like Milwaukee, I don't think, where it's just going to be the only chance of any winners will be them.
Yeah. Well, Costa in the Team Pelfrey car has really proved that he has some serious speed. Like I said last week, it would have been really interesting to see Costa in that 82 machine from the beginning of the season. I think our championship would look very, very different. But anyway, so that is it for our Mazda Road to Indy. And we now move on to the world of rally.
Yes, the world of rally, and try and get through this fairly quick. There's a whole lot going on this weekend. Busy, busy, busy. We get to, first of all, kick off with the WRC, and we have the WRC Germany, which is the first of the asphalt events of the year, and what an epic place. I mean, there's nothing like the different transitions that you have at
And,
at
you know,
Rally Germany.
I've mentioned this before. I really wish that Rally America would have an asphalt rally.
So, yeah, there is a tarmac event that is in the NASA Rally Sport. Unfortunately, Rally America does not have a tarmac event. There's a number of areas that would be awesome for it. If they could pick up the Empire State, that would be cool. But then again, it would be yet another East Coast event the calendar is just full of. But and you had a little bit of tarmac on the Mount Washington hill climb. I mean, only the top last few miles were gravel there or dirt. So, you know, you got a little bit of tarmac in there, I guess.
Yeah. It's something. Hill climb. So back to Deutschland.
Deutschland, yeah. You know, what's great about it is there's three distinct different types of stages you have there. You have the super narrow and twisty roads in the Mosel-Vineyard Valley. And that's where you just see them just going, you know, they'll be going up a hill, hairpin, you know, up a hill, you know, hairpin. And these are roads that are really, they're kind of the, I mean, they're tarmac, but they're really the farm roads for working on these vineyards. And, I mean, they're basically on this canyon wall, just kind of going up and up and up. And they're one car wide roads. I mean, there is no room to pass kind of thing if, it, you know, it's not two lane traffic. So very wide or very narrow, twisty roads to do there. Then you've got, of course, the mega stages that are the Bumholder military range. That's where you have to watch out for the Hinkelsteins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's roads that tanks drive on because it's part of the military range where they test the tanks. And that's the Hinkelsteins are for, is to prevent a tank from going too far off the road. And they, you know, it's basically like speed bumps for them to keep them kind of in line, right? But the rally cars go on those, and those are very... It's worn tarmac, you know, it's beat up, it's dusty, throw in some rain and they're downright treacherous. And that's like a 40 kilometer stage that they're doing on Saturday for that one. So those are going to be amazing to witness there. And then they're going to some a little bit smoother country roads that are in the Saarland area, which is closer to Belgium. This is probably part of the push of Hyundai and Thierry Neuville, their top driver, who is a Belgian, kind of have some stages up in that direction. So it'll be interesting to see the different setups that they do, because you're going to want, you know, like a softer suspension, maybe set up for the rough and changing conditions that you have out there on the Panzerplatte with the military range versus, you know, for a super tight setup, maybe for, the smooth tarmac, you know, versus, you know, whatever setup you're going to do for all the overseer you're going to need for all the hairpins in the Mosel Valley area. So a lot of compromise you have to do. And then there's the weather. If history proves true, they get afternoon thunderstorms regularly in the area.
Yeah.
And so you'll start out in the morning, it'll be nice and dry, and you'll think it's going to be fine. And then, boom, it just dumps down. And that changes everything. It can make all any one of these stages treacherous. And it's a real big gamble on what you do with the tires. What tires do you put in the boot to, or when do you switch to rains versus dry? So it makes for a very interesting challenge.
Now, they still allow they still allow teams to change at will, right? Is there a time once you leave the service park, that's it?
Well, as far as what you have in the boot, you know, if you have, say, you have two spares in the back,
well, yeah,
and you have a couple of wets in there and you're on dries and you decide to do, let's say, wets in the front and the rear is being dry, or some cross pattern, which has been an interesting combination, you can definitely do that in between stages anytime that you want.
Okay.
But there isn't a full, you know, you meet up with your crew somewhere along the way and, you know, in between.
Well, no. You can pack your spares as different tires than what are on the car. That is correct. There's no weird FAA funny business trying to force some sense of misguided cost control or something like that.
Well, there is in the count of tires that they have available. So
okay.
They do have you know, a limited number of the soft tires and the hard compound and the rain tires that they can choose from. So they will have to play a little bit of that. They should have a sufficient enough for the rally, but they might have to play a little bit of a game of how many hards do I want to use versus how many softs do I want to use?
Right, right. Well, especially
so that'll
if you
play
have,
a little bit.
Yeah, especially if you have rain. Mm-hmm. You know, the softs generally will give you a little better performance in the rain, but if it dries out, then maybe you're kind of screwed at the last few kilometers of the stage.
That's exactly it. So it's all about that compromise, and especially when you get into Saturday with the, you know, 40-kilometer stage of the on the Bumholder military range of the Panzerplatte, that's it'll definitely play out there. You know, let's say, yeah, it's just drying up after being moist earlier or something like that. Are you going to risk it and go with the hards, or are you going to go with the softs? Well, you start with the softs, you might be beginning of it, you might be quick. But then your tires start to fall off,
right?
You know, so it's definitely going to be a bit of a challenge there. What's also so exciting about this round, the tarmac rallies end up, you've got times that are really close to each other in a lot of these cases. You don't have the road sweeping effect. What you do have that's different from that, though, is you have the corner cuts where debris gets put on the tarmac,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you start cutting these corners and mud gets on the asphalt and whatnot. So the guys farther back actually have a disadvantage versus on the gravel. The farther back you are, the more of an advantage you normally have, because the cars in front of you is swept clear and gotten down to the nice bedrock underneath. So tarmac, it's a little bit different story. It's in reverse. You want to be closer to the front.
As they cut into the, you know, the inside into the ditch, pulling the turf back up onto the line, and of course it's being laid up right exactly where you want to be back
braking,
squeezing the throttle, right?
Right, exactly.
On corner exit.
You're right, where you're wanting to hit the throttle, so you have to maybe delay that a little bit. And if they're really spitting it up and out there, you know, it can even affect a little bit of your braking zone, you know, all of that stuff. So that makes a little bit of a challenge. But I mean, last year it came down to the final stage, the final split time before you knew the winner.
Yeah.
Between Thierry Neuville and Danny Sordo. And Danny Sordo ended up coming out the win. But it took a mistake from Neuville, who actually slid off the road landed on a side road, off a, basically kind of slid down a little hill and was able to get back on, but he lost like 30 seconds and ended up losing the rally, you know, ended up getting second place. But it was definitely an exciting event, and I don't expect it to be any less exciting this year. I guess last year what was interesting is you had both Volkswagens were out day two. Day one, Ogier was out. Day two, Latvala was out, which was unusual. I'm not sure if on tarmac if Ogier is quite as quick as he is on gravel. I mean, he's a good tarmac driver for sure, but he wasn't like Loeb on tarmac. He hasn't won everything on tarmac. And Latvala is definitely just as quick, but you've got so many good other tarmac drivers out there right now that I think Loeb never had, I think, this kind of a challenge when it came to the tarmac. Thierry Neuville with the Hyundai. The Hyundai's been really torquey and really good when it comes to tarmac. I'm really excited to see how well this car is going to do with all the testing they've done on tarmac. If you remember, I reported maybe about a month ago or whatever, Brian Bouffier, which one of their test drivers, won one of their one of the French tarmac, you know, French rallies in their car, using that as a test. And they've been working real hard to make sure that car is pretty quick there. So I think the Hyundais could do real well. And again, Thierry Neuville is a tarmac specialist. Danny Sordo, the winner of last year. He was in a Citroen last year. He's in Hyundai this year. He has a potential to be up there at the front. Robert Kubica, you know, that Formula One experience. You know, he's in the Ford Fiesta. It's proven to be really good on tarmac. He definitely has a shot to at least get a stage win or two. I don't think he's gonna be out there for the all out win.
You know, he's had some consistency issues.
Yes, he has.
And so he'll be exciting to watch, but I don't think he's any real threat for a podium, is he?
Third place at best. But with the stacked field, I really don't think that. I think he's gonna be a little bit farther back. I'd say maybe like a fifth place is probably more likely for him.
Okay.
But I do expect him to at least get one stage win. I think he's going to push a little bit, like on a second run through a stage, just to see where he's at versus the everybody else. Might push a little harder than the guys that are, you know, looking at the championship or whatever, you know, where they end up seeding in there. Kubica's definitely going to be up there, but yeah, I think he knows that he doesn't have the experience yet on these stages. So. The other ones to look out for, Citroën. Obviously, with the car being designed around Loeb to begin with, Chris Meek is amazing on tarmac. He's always been really quick, always been up near the front. He's faltered a little bit, pushing a little too hard for himself and going off course. But coming off his amazing third win that he third place out at Finland, I'd expect him to be up there in the top three again at here in Germany. He's been just so confident. And that's what kind of he needs. It's kind of a psychological barrier with him.
Okay.
And I think the Citroen's definitely going to be up there as well. If you notice, I didn't really mention Mikko Hirvonen at all.
Oh, well, no. Hirvonen has some issues. But let's go back to the Citroëns, because you didn't mention Ogier either.
Well, Ogier's not with Citroën. He's with VW.
Oh, that's right. But, he's in the Polo.
But I did not mention Mads Østberg, is what you're probably thinking.
Yeah.
You know, Mads still has been learning when it comes to the tarmac. If it rains a lot, that'll be an advantage for him. You know, he's used to more slippery stuff, and I think that's a great equalizer. He did an amazing job a couple years ago driving in, I think it was in Spain. They had this downpour that hit, and this downpour ended up, you know, making everything so slippery. Everybody else was going off the road, and he was able to manage everything and did really well. So
let's go back to Hirvonen.
Mm-hmm.
He has skill. He has pace. But it seems like the last couple of years, he has lost his mental game.
That's kind of it, isn't it? I don't know. He needs to get his mojo back, really.
Yeah.
I mean, he definitely has the skill and the talent. He's proven it before. I mean, he was 1 point away from winning the championship away from Loeb, closer than most people have ever been. And I'm not sure what it is. Is it completely psychological? You know, I think I said a couple weeks ago, I mean, when he was at Finland, he kept second-guessing the setup he had on the car. You know, he had it set up one way. He's like, something doesn't feel right. And then really what wasn't feeling right is him.
Right.
And so he changes the setup, you know, raises it up, lowers it down, softens it or tightens it, whatever it was. And then he's like, now it's worse than it was before. okay, snap out of it. You know, you, from the testing you did earlier, the setup was fine. You just got to get yourself in the groove.
Yeah.
You know, some people are saying that it's getting to be near the end of his career. The guy's like 34 years old.
He's running out of chances. And Peter, as a driver, have you ever been in a funk like that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It definitely goes on and off. He's been so close so many years that I think it's tough for him to kind of get back on the horse. And there's really, it's tough for him because I don't think that Ford is, you know, or wait, is he a Ford or Citroen in the track?
He's a Ford, yep.
He's a Ford, yeah. The Ford, I don't think, is 100% there, you know, for sure. I mean, even Wilson kind of came out with an article saying he was pretty disappointed with, you know, his pace at Finland, which, you know, usually he's pretty phenomenal at. So it's going to be, it's tough. I mean, I feel like he needs to just go out there, and he's always Mr. Consistency, but his pace has definitely been lacking this year.
He needs to have at least a couple of stage wins for him to prove his worth. There's a lot of young up-and-coming drivers that would love to have that seat at Ford. And if he wants to keep it, he's going to have to push a little bit. And, yeah, like you said, he's definitely been Mr. Consistency, but he's going to have to throw that consistency a little bit out the window and push a little bit harder. And I'm hoping he can do it. But unfortunately, tarmac is not his greatest surface. I think we won't really see any greatness from him until we go to Australia or something like that. Anyway, still, Germany... It's going to be 3 days of awesomeness. So if you have WRC Plus now, which is awesome, they just actually upgraded their service with the mobile capability of WRC Plus. So thank you for finally adding that. So one of my many requests has been fulfilled now. If they'd add coverage of the other subcategories, of which here at the Rally Deutschland, they're going to have not only WRC, but it's going to be the full everything. You got WRC 2, WRC 3 is going to be there. The Junior WRC is going to be racing. The DMAC Cup, you're going to have, with the WRC 3, you're going to have that GT86 car racing in that category, right? You're going to have an RGT car, Tuthill Porsche, who's done like the Safari Classic rally. They've got a 997 RGT with beautiful sound coming out of it that's going to be racing here.
You know, since this is tarmac, and we're talking about doing, you know, ditch hooks and all that, the guys running the 86, they've got to run with a cup of water in the car, right?
A cup of water?
See, those of you who are anime fans just got that joke, and those of you who aren't didn't, and Google it. That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, I watched some anime, but not quite as much as you. So.
It was a shout out to Initial D.
Ah, okay, not one I have seen. So
where the old Toyota Corolla Terreno, the AE86 platform, was the main character. Some people think it was the driver of the car that was the main character, but no, it was the car. It was the car.
It's always the car.
That's the way it should be. Car. The car is the character. Yes.
Right. So anyway, sorry to distract.
That's okay. So speaking of tires, like we were talking about the different blends needed and whatnot for Rally Germany, Michelin, who's been their main supplier of the WRC teams, has decided they are going to extend their partnership, at least as the official tire supplier, through the end of 2016.
Nice.
So two more years there. They seem to be pretty happy with a combination of, A, how long the season is. It keeps their name out there very consistently. They're very happy with some of the video coverage being very much with prominence of Michelin in everybody's face.
Right, right.
What's interesting is also to see that they were stating here that in 2013, 600 million fans worldwide followed WRC on TV. I don't know. Sometimes those numbers feel a little inflated, but if that's true, that's awesome.
Well, keep in mind, there's better coverage elsewhere than there is here.
That's very, very true. They seem very excited about the progress forward they're doing with their digital stuff. And if you've ever actually looked at their YouTube channel, the Michelin, they've got their own little WRC feed, and they've got some great little short videos from each one of the days of the rally that are just kind of cinematic. There's no talking in it. It's just kind of music and, you know,
there
maybe some close-ups.
There shouldn't be talking. There should just be the sound of the engine.
Right, and that's what it is. Yeah, a lot of it's the sound of the engines or some, you know, just some music in the background. You know, of course, they're going to do some slow-mos of the tires as they're spitting out gravel and stuff on a stage start.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the beauty shots.
Exactly, you know. But they get some great, great shots in there. One of my favorite ones that they did, it was showing some of the night stage stuff in Spain, I think it was last year, and you got those glowing brake rotors and mm-hmm. stuff. And always fun to see it with the sparks as you were.
Yes. Oh, that was so epic. That was so epic.
So good to see Michelin sticking with it. WRC needs to keep sponsors in there, and I'm hoping to see it continue on like that. So, of other rally-age this weekend, I'm going to switch gears to Global Rallycross, Red Bull Global Rallycross Championship. They're actually going to be out there in Daytona this weekend on Saturday. And
at Daytona Motor Speedway or just in Daytona?
No, at Daytona Motor Speedway. Okay. Yes, yes, yes.
You know, it'll be fun. It's where I'm going to do a little exhibition rallycross. Do it old school. Do it down on Daytona Beach. Yeah, you know, like they used to do back in the day. Wouldn't that be cool?
That'd be interesting to see them on the sand there for a bit. Mm-hmm. But they do use a tarmac-based tire, so that probably works.
That's why I say
so
as
well.
An exhibition, you can always do a run, a one-off type of fun thing.
But what's really interesting to hear about this track is, you know, we've had the best track so far that we've had, at least distance-wise, was at Barbados. I can't remember the exact length of it, but it was pretty good-sized track, and we didn't have really any red flags other than when Ken Block had his instance where he flipped over, and when Tanner Faust decided to overjump and kept driving, even though he lost a door to his car and whatnot.
Simplify and add lightness.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you'll have to say that something about that at the very end. Anyway, what's neat about this track is they've actually come up with a design that is actually almost a mile long, 13 turns, and it's got the Joker in the very first turn at the start there. That's actually brilliant, and I'm really, really excited to see this one. I think the cars have needed more length to be able to stretch their legs.
Yep.
The Joker being in the very first turn, it's huge, because this is what they do in Europe, and I'm sorry, those people that, like, we don't want to compare ourselves to Europe. They do it very frequently in Europe, because what it does, it forces the cars to make a decision on that very first start to split the field to prevent those red flags. When everybody barrels into a first turn and all tries to go the same way, it's just too narrow. I'm sorry, there's only one best line to take. When you have 4, 6, or 8, or 10 cars trying to go for that same spot, something's going to happen, and you have the red flags.
Yeah.
And I think this design here is the best design I have seen all season. It's very interesting. You got, you know, a nice hairpin after that turn one. I got a link there. I don't know if you guys looked at it. You know, transitions to gravel after another hairpin, and then you got the jump in there. I mean, not a lot of gravel in there. I think it's maybe about, well, I guess you'd say 25% gravel. The rest of it's tarmac.
Okay.
But they got some really interesting turns in there. Really tight hairpin. What is that? Turn about like 7 or 8 or something like that. Before some high-speed sweepers to get back out onto like that main straight area. One thing you can't really see from here is whether there's an elevation change, but I think that's what they're trying to depict here in this picture. I mean, it's a drawing. It's not an actual picture of the design. But if there's elevation change as well, this is just going to be freaking epic.
You know, that was
unless they do something like they do when they build the Supercross track in the quad oval there, they'd have to artificially make any elevation changes. We're talking about Florida; it's as flat as Indianapolis.
Yeah, but it's inside a racing venue where they put dirt in all kinds of different places to build up stuff. So viewing areas and things like that. So you never know.
You know, they can create a little elevation change, but you know, one of the hallmarks of European rallycross is that you have mid-Ohio type of elevation change,
mm-hmm.
and that can produce some opportunities for people to make mistakes. Let us say.
You know, and that's what I like about it is, especially when you get into those like off camber, turns as they're coming down the hill, and then they have to turn to come back up, and it makes for a very challenging drive. And the skilled drivers are the ones that are gonna get the best lap times and come out on top. So really, really excited about this event. Except rumor has it, ouch. Toby Moody, who's done the announcements for when it was with the X Games, is gonna maybe be announcing this one.
Yeah, so turn down the volume.
Yeah, this is definitely gonna be one of those, mute.
Yeah.
You know, I
and just don't get suckered into buying some OxyClean.
Yeah, I don't think that's a showstopper. It's not,
you know, the racing will speak for itself. Like you said, just hit mute or turn it down. But the race course looks to be, like I said, the best I've seen all year. I've also been hearing that the designs coming up for LA and up at Dirtfish are going to be similarly very interesting. Red Bull GRC, they're still experimenting, so I'm giving them a little bit of slack. This is a very good step forward. I hope it's a design they continue forward with other tracks. So we'll see how that goes. So tune in. Yeah, that'll be this Saturday at, you know, I didn't click the link on there. What time is the race, guys?
Do they say? I was looking at the track layout. And
there we go. 2:30 p.m. Eastern time.
Ah, there you go. There you go, then.
There you go. So,
well, we've also got another race this weekend.
We do have another race. We finally have another Rally America event, and it'll be out there in the Ojibwe forests out there. And the Ojibwe Forest Rally, that's always an interesting one. You're right there next to the lakes, and it's kind of a little more that sandy kind of gravel out there. So That'll be a fun one to do out there by Detroit. They're going to actually make it a 3-day event, which is a new thing for Ojibwe.
I saw that.
Yeah, they decided they're going to add an extra day in there by using a local sports car track as a little exhibition. Mm-hmm. They're going to use some of the gravel areas that are like the service area, kind of like they do at PIR.
Right.
And they're going to do a little thing there for the spectators to try and draw in fans. And I think that's a smart move. I think more of their venues should have that kind of spectator stage thing, kind of draw people out. Because, rally isn't the easiest thing to spectate without, you know, hiking it out into the woods a little bit.
Right. And, you know, super specials like that are a great way to do that. You know, the super special at 100 Acre is lackluster. But, of course, you know, out there at, what is it, the Oregon Trail that they use PIR?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so, you know, there you have built-in seating, you have built-in infrastructure. It's a great place. Hey, come out and see the rally cars. Then go hiking in the woods and see more of it. But you set the hook with the super special.
Exactly, you know. And, you know, I mean, they're not pushing to their all-out limit in these cases because you can never win a rally on a super special. You can always lose one, as they say.
just ask Pastrana.
Yeah.
Speaking of 100 Acre Wood.
Yeah, that little culvert.
Yep.
Just went a little wide and bonk.
Bonk.
That's all it takes, man. That's all it takes. So, yeah, I mean, Ojibwe is going to be interesting to watch. I mean, most of the championships are wrapped up, right? You got two-wheel drives already wrapped up. You know, Higgins has won the main open class championship. You've got the B-Spec is already done. Super Production looks like it's probably going to go Van Way's way. I mean, he's well enough ahead in the points. He just needs to kind of finish well, and it's probably his. But these guys still race to win. I mean, it's no reason to not watch this one. Actually, Higgins, with Craig Drew at his side, has never won Ojibwe. He actually has had mechanical issues or when Block was there, he beat him last year. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, the Higgins versus Pastrana out there, of course. But what'll also be interesting is David Sterricks, who won out here at Oregon Trail this year. He's last year's Super Production champion. He missed out on the last couple of rounds. And, you know, I was kind of wondering what happened with him. I know he's been racing a little bit in the Pirelli World Challenge with Always Evolving. Well, it turns out they've been converting the car into open class.
You know, when we looked at the, what was it, last week?
Yeah,
you know, we were looking at the entry list, and we thought maybe it was a print error.
I certainly did. I thought, you know, they make errors sometimes in the early, you know, entry stuff, and you know they fix them later. But turns out there is no error there. It is completely 100%. He is going to be in open class with his 2011 WRX STI. What modifications he's exactly done has not been released yet. I'm really excited to see. Obviously, carbon fiber, you know, to lighten up cars is a big feature there.
Right.
Amping the power out of the engine is another feature. You know, there's a number of things that you can do that go beyond the super production. So what'll be interesting to watch with him is what is his pace as a, you know, a career racer like David Higgins is, versus Pastrana and Higgins? How far off the pace, even though he's not a factory back car, just how much per mile, you know, how many seconds per mile is he going to be a little bit slower than them? It might not be much. Not to mention him converting at this part of the season is actually a perfect test to get ready for next season, right? Well, you've got the next two as a test, really, right?
That's what that I take out of this. This is, you know, this is really now an opportunity to have two full rallies for development of the car.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so it's not a focus of winning necessarily, although certainly they're going to be pushing to win. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's not about trying to take the fight to everyone this year. It's about getting this car dialed in, sorted out, so they can take the fight to them next year.
And what might end up being extra interesting here is that next year, because they actually thought they were going to introduce it this year, and I have yet to see it, but the 2015 WRX STI was supposed to eventually be the car that they're using.
Yeah.
They're still using the older chassis. So there's going to be a little bit of a development side on the factory team, of which a well-developed Sterix could end up being a challenge for next year's championship, actually.
That would be good to see. You know, I'd like to see someone other than, well, of course, Block is checked out, right? He comes and runs for the fun of it every now and then, but he's no longer involved in the championship aspect.
Not as much as he'd like to be. Yeah, unfortunately,
well, you know,
his commitments
like
for
to
his
be,
sponsors
but...
and, yeah, he's got all these events he does around the world where he just can't commit to
money.
The full season. Yeah. Well, that's how he pays for having the car.
Right, right. But anyway, so no, that's good. Any surprises that you see coming from Ojibwe?
You know, what'll be interesting to see mostly probably be the super production between Nick Roberts and Dylan Van Wey. Even though it seems like it's going to just go to Van Wey. This is Roberts' home turf, and he stomped Van Wey last year here. And it'll be interesting to see. Van Wey's increased his pace quite a bit, and I really want to see how that plays out here. The other fun one to watch is going to be maybe the Brakem Racing's BMW M3.
Well, and they got a new co-driver.
They had to get a new co-driver, yeah. So last minute, they were actually asking on Facebook, anybody know a co-driver with, I think it was... with rather large testicles was the or if a girl, the equivalent, I believe, was what they asked.
Right. Attachments. Let's use Hobbs.
Attachments. Okay.
Large attachments.
But yes, they have found a co-driver. I can't remember who it is that's confirmed there, but they did find someone. So it'll definitely be fun to watch them out there. You know, I'd like to see more of the rear-wheel drives out there racing along. So, that's just an awesome car. You just can't do much better than the sound of having that raw power out there, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a beautiful thing, man.
Let's see. I saw the post earlier today. Jimmy Brandt is their new co-driver.
Ah, okay. Jimmy Brandt. I'm not terribly familiar with him, but I hope they do well. They had some issues. They've had some mechanical issues here and there. And what's great is just how big a promoters they are of rally and just helping grow the sport. Next year, actually, I'm really interested. It sounds like they might be doing the entire Rally America season. Nothing's been announced yet, but they had some interesting meetings with Red Bull. So it'd be interesting. It would be kind of cool to see a Red Bull sponsored rally car. That's an older BMW out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, again, that car has just got the sound, and the team has that great interaction with the fans via social media, and you know, giving away T-shirts and broken parts off their cars. You know, they're so excited, like, look what we broke today. Who wants one? You know, it's just pretty cool. You know, I like to see that. So. And really, I kind of want to finish off with a huge, huge congratulations to the driver for Scion's, the Rally XD, and former Rally America host of their YouTube channel. They were doing their videos then. Matthew Johnson and Chrissy Beavis, the co-driver for Travis Pastrana, mm-hmm. tied the knot. They just posted it on Facebook today. So huge congratulations to them. They're both great people and awesome rallyists. And Their kid is going to be a champion. I know it. When they have kids, their kid will be a champion.
So, Peter, the season ends for you at Sonoma.
It does.
There's the Lake Superior Performance Rally in October. Ever thought about branching out into doing some gravel stuff, driving her straight sideways?
I'd love to. I'd probably do that too much in the snow.
Oh, so you're going to be a snowdrift? Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah.
Preseason. Yeah, he's going to bring the Van Diemen with snow tires up to up to snowdrift. That'd be brilliant, actually.
I can't think of anything wrong with that idea.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, it has been an evening. And for those of you who are still listening to us, wow, thank you, both of you. We appreciate it. For Mr. Shaw, Mr. Olsikowski, this is Doug Patterson to say thank you very much to our special guest, Peter Portante, and to all of you listeners out there. And keep the shiny side up. We'll see you next week.